Welcome to the Nuclear Medicine and Molecular Medicine Podcast, Episode 35, Dr. Andrew Scott and the Ludwig Institute. This is another interview from the Society of Nuclear Medicine 2009 India. And again, I've managed to speak to one of the most interesting speakers that was at the meeting, and that's Dr. Andrew Scott from Melbourne. He's director of the Ludwig Institute, one of the greatest, certainly the biggest cancer research organisation in the world. So it was indeed a privilege to speak to him, and I'm sure you'll find this podcast very interesting. Please pass any information on about the podcast to your colleagues. Let them know about how to get hold of it. Go into iTunes, type in Nuclear Medicine under podcasting, or go to nukecast.com, nuccast.com, and there you can get hold of my email address and give me an email to let me know what you like about the podcast and what you don't like. That way I can do my best to give you what you like. So please let your colleagues know. But without further ado, let's get on to the interview with Dr. Andrew Scott. So here we are at the SNM India 2009 again, and I've got an interview with Dr. Andrew Scott. He's the head of the Ludwig Institute in Melbourne, Australia, and he gave a talk today that was that covered a lot of interesting areas, but the main area was really on some of the new cellular targets and new targeting for therapy and diagnosis in nuclear medicine. But before we get into too many questions about that, I'll just get Dr. Scott to tell us a bit about the Ludwig Institute.
So the Ludwig Institute for Cancer Research is the largest multinational not-for-profit cancer research organisation. It's now 35 years old, and it's actually a Swiss non-for-profit entity, and there are 10 branches around the world which function solely to look into the causes, treatments and prevention of cancer. So there's almost 1,000 scientists and clinicians worldwide that work within the Institute, and the branch that I'm the director of in Melbourne has just over 100 clinicians and scientists which are working on mainly therapeutic strategies for cancer, but also biomarkers and imaging. I'm also the director of the PET Centre at the Austin Hospital in Melbourne, which is where our Institute branch is located.
So a lot of the work you're doing, I gather, would be investigating new compounds, in particular doing animal research and then bridging that to human research.
Yeah, so there are two main areas of my own research. The first is to try and identify new targets that may be important in the growth of cancer cells and to develop new treatments based on mainly proteins and antibodies that are directed to those targets. And we intimately use nuclear medicine techniques to look at where the compounds go in the body and how they're actually affecting the cancer cells. The other main area of my clinical work and research is molecular imaging, particularly PET and SPECT in cancer, and also nuclear therapy in cancer patients as well.
Well, so some of the compounds you looked at, and I can remember you talking about them on previous occasions, they have a very long lead time in terms of developing these things. Why is that? Why does it take so long for these new compounds to actually go from an idea to a product?
Well, of course, it depends on whether you're talking about a new diagnostic imaging molecule or whether you're talking about a potential therapeutic. For a diagnostic imaging molecule, you can probably take a new compound into the clinic, whether it's a SPECT or PET-based compound, within about 18 months to 2 years, provided that you've got adequate resources to do that. Implicit within that, of course, is to be able to conduct the clinical trials in an appropriate way and to be able to file the regulatory submissions to enable you to do that. But we've got a lot of experience now in doing that. From a therapy perspective, it's much more complex because you're talking about drugs or compounds which can actually have toxic effects and therapeutic effects. So unlike nuclear medicine imaging compounds, which have no real effect on the body per se, these molecules have to be very stringently worked up. They have to be produced under very, very stringent conditions. And normally the lead time would be anywhere from 3 to 7 years before coming up with a molecule and being able to take it into clinical study. Obviously, when doing it from an academic viewpoint, it takes a lot longer than if you're in a big pharmaceutical company because they have huge resources to do that. And it's a great challenge, and you have to understand all of the issues of how to make it, all the toxicology issues, the regulatory issues, how to design your trials. But once you do get it in the clinic, obviously it's very rewarding. And so we've taken probably 5 or 6 different potential therapeutics into the clinic over the last 10 years. And all of them at the moment are finishing their phase 1 trial results, and hopefully we'll be going into phase 2 trials, or some are in phase 2 already.
Yeah, I think it's important that you're concentrating on therapeutics, because we've always been reasonably good at diagnosis, and we're still good at diagnosis, but we haven't improved the outcome, particularly the metastatic cancer, much in 20 years, really, in that respect. Would you agree with that?
Well, again, I think that there's been quite significant strides in the last 10 years in a number of areas with nuclear medicine therapy. Certainly the treatment of bone pain has been very successful, and some of the more recent results with the newer beta and even alpha emitter treatments, or combining these therapies with chemotherapy, is showing very important results, not just for treatment of bone pain, but also actually causing the prevention of new lesions from becoming painful and even having an inhibitory effect on the bone metastases. I think that also within the last 10 years, the use of radiolabeled anti-CD20 antibodies, Bexxar and Zevalin, has been a huge step forward, so that's been terrific. And there's even been one therapeutic compound for lung cancer, which is an I-131 labelled antibody, which has been approved in China, of all places, in the last few years. But there's no question that if we're trying to deliver radiation with radionuclides to solid tumours, particularly patients with advanced or metastatic disease, we still have significant challenges. But we've learnt a lot over the last 5 to 6 years in particular, and being able to design these proteins in a way in which they can have improved efficacy is obviously the key. And of course, the final area where there's great excitement and a lot of progress is in the neuroendocrine tumours, where the radiolabeled peptides, particularly with the new lutetium-based trials, are really showing impressive results. And here at the Indian Society of Nuclear Medicine meeting, there's been quite a lot of data shown on their results, which are obviously very exciting, and paralleling those that are coming from the various European groups, UK in particular.
As we're at the Indian meeting, I think along with the regulatory difficulties that are particularly in the United States and in Europe, do you think India might have a strong role to play in the future in developing new compounds and certainly trialling ones, even ones that are developed elsewhere?
Yeah. So I think that's a very important point. Interestingly, when you look at the way in which clinical trials, particularly in cancer, which I mainly work in, are being conducted around the world, the big biotechs and pharmaceutical companies are looking for sites that can actually recruit patients quickly, but can also do studies to what we call good clinical research practice, or GCRP. Now, historically, that's really been mainly in Western countries, European, US, UK, even Australia. But in recent times, there has been a marked increase in the number of very good sites that are recruiting large numbers of patients in Eastern Europe, India, and also emerging in China as well. So the advantage that they have here is that they have a very low cost base, which is very important. They have a huge number of patients, and they have very well-trained clinicians, many of whom have worked for a number of years in UK, Europe, US, sometimes even Australia. And so there's an increasing trend for the clinical trials to be done here. So provided that people are trained well, and this applies in nuclear medicine as well, they can do trials into large numbers of patients in multi-centre prospective studies, I think, in the future, in a very, very competitive way. The second area is in the actual production of the radioisotopes and the compounds to be labelled with. Being able to use the facilities and technologies in India, both from an isotope production side, where they really have very sophisticated, not just cyclotron, but also reactor-based isotope production, as well as being able to produce proteins, peptides, small molecules in their generic manufacturing facilities, which are also very, very prominent and increasingly important here in India, they really could have a competitive edge into the future, I believe.
Getting back to targeting cells, there's been a plethora of different potential ways of doing it, from affibodies to nanobodies to antibody fragments to whole antibodies to manufactured peptides to all sorts of areas. Is it a case of letting a thousand flowers bloom, or do you really think there's some particular areas that people should be concentrating on?
I think it's horses for courses. I think that there are so many targets that we now know exist, both on the surface of cancer cells and in cancer cells, and even in the environment surrounding the cells, the stroma of the tumours, that the therapeutic strategies we can adopt really depends on the target we select. It also depends on whether we want to image the process that the therapy is having an effect on, or if we want to actually deliver radioisotopes and radiation to the tumours themselves. And whether or not the tumours are actually radiosensitive is also extremely important. So as we've talked about previously, I think that where you have peptide-based approaches, that can be extremely efficacious, particularly when you're using isotopes which have very, very high energy beta emissions or possibly alphas, and I think that the neuroendocrine tumours is an example of that. Leukemias, lymphomas are much more amenable to larger size proteins, so I think antibodies can be very useful for targeting and for therapy and delivering radiation.
Because it doesn't have to cross cell membranes, so it can get there.
That's right. Because they're what we call liquid tumours. In other words, the antibodies can easily go through the bloodstream or to bone marrow, spleen and so on, and quickly target almost all the cells within sometimes 6 to 12 hours.
And that would also apply to treating infections.
Absolutely. In the non-cancer area, I think that would be very relevant. And of course, the whole concept of treating infection with radionuclides would be, again, a very important concept to take forward. But if you're dealing with solid tumours where you have sometimes very large volumes of disease, it takes quite a while because of the interstitial pressure and poor blood flow to penetrate into them, we need to be looking at protein scaffolds or constructs which can actually both clear quickly from blood so you don't get as much bystander toxicity to red marrow, but actually have high cumulative uptake in the tumour to deliver radiation to lesions which are often quite radio-resistant. And even combination treatments where you combine the radiation with chemotherapy and so on clearly is an important strategy, and that's part of the work that we're doing.
You mentioned combination treatments. I mean, there's been compounds now that can show radiation protection, particularly for kidneys, and then there's other compounds that show radiation sensitisation. And I suppose all chemotherapeutic agents are really radiosensitised in one way because they help prevent repair mostly. So do you think that's inevitably where we're going to go in that sort of area?
I do. I think that for a long time we've tended to believe that just the delivery of radiation alone is enough, but we need to, I think, really look at the lessons that are being learned in other clinical areas where combination treatments can clearly give increased efficacy or even synergy. We should not be afraid of trying to combine our radionuclide treatments with chemotherapy or tyrosine kinase inhibitors and so on. There are specific types of chemotherapy that work best with radiation because of their synergistic effect on preventing DNA damage repair. We need to be smart in how we do this, but I do think that there are great opportunities there.
Perhaps we could finish off by just talking about the specific traces or therapeutic agents that you're working on at the moment that are coming close to trial or use.
Well, one of the compounds which I talked about at the meeting here is a humanised monoclonal antibody against a target called A33, which is expressed in colorectal cancer. And we've generated this antibody. We've conducted some initial trials showing that it beautifully targets metastatic colorectal cancer, that we can deliver radiation, probably not enough by itself to actually cause shrinkage of tumor, but it can delay the growth of tumors significantly. We've just completed a trial combining the radiolabeled antibody with chemotherapy, in this case capecitabine, which has its own effect in colorectal cancer but can also synergize with the radiotherapy in treating the cancer cells. And we hope to extend this by looking at new isotopes such as lutetium-177 rather than I-131 and other sensitizers moving forward.
So by using alpha emitters, then that's going to help stop resistance because you're going to be more likely to knock out the cells rather than just damage them?
So most of the work we've done so far in colorectal cancer have been with beta emitters.
Yep.
Alpha emitters, I think, could potentially play a role. Having an appropriate half-life for an alpha emitter would be key because you actually need at 2 to 3 days to be able to properly penetrate these proteins into the centre parts of the tumours. So you need something which has a half-life which extends at least to that length of time. But certainly in small volume disease, and with some of the newer alpha emitters that are coming out, they may have a possibility.
Well, thank you for your time. But before I let you go, perhaps you could tell us what you've found the highlight of the meeting so far and what you've thought about your time in India.
Well, India is a very unusual place, as people who've been here know. It's hectic, it's crowded, the traffic is amazing, the people are amazing. I think the meeting here, I've been very impressed with. There is work which is being done in India, particularly with SPECT-CT, therapeutic studies with peptide-based approaches in neuroendocrine tumours. Their treatment of some of the standard diseases, particularly thyroid carcinoma, is very impressive. But they also have a burgeoning PET program showing very interesting confirmatory results to what we've seen elsewhere in many of the classic tumour indications. But some of their therapy areas, I think, show great promise, and their reactor and cyclotrons are really pivotally poised for that. So I've been impressed and enjoyed the time here.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your time.
I'm going to put a link on the podcast webpage, that's nuccast.com, to the Lurie Institute, so you can see some of the work they're doing there. I was very impressed by the intensity and the energy of the work that's going on, and at last I think we're getting ahead of cancer, and with work like Dr. Andrew Scott, I think we can be very pleased that at last we're making some headway into that. For those that are interested in some of these things we've talked about, particularly the peptides, we've talked about them previously on the podcast. And from last week, we also referred to hepatobiliary imaging with Dr. Krishnamurthy. That was also a previous episode on the podcast. If you go to iTunes, click on the podcast link, and then type in NucleoMeds, and you can see all of the episodes there. If you just click Get All, that'll enable you to listen to all of the podcasts that we've had, and I'm sure you'll find that very interesting because there's a lot of relevant issues that we've covered previously that I'm sure will expand on what Dr. Scott said today. So please get in touch with me, tell me what you think. I appreciate any help that you can give me in terms of what you'd like to do, particularly if you've got an interesting project that you're sure our listeners would be interested in. I know some people have already expressed some interest, so please get back in touch, make sure that we can get a Skype recording of your ventures, and I'm sure until next time, cheerio. Thanks, bye.